From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
San Bruno.
North Sunnyvale.
Downtown Palo Alto. My beloved.
Redwood City.
Coming up, we learn about a committee of volunteers in San Francisco who keep their eyes on the city's books.
Not the sexy committee in the city that people fall over each other to serve on.
No, but it's worth billions of dollars. Then we'll follow food from the warehouse to the food bank to find out some of what it takes to feed those in need.
Every single day we have huge 18-wheelers deliver truckloads upon truckloads of produce.
A tour of San Francisco's food bank and a visit to a tiny oasis in the middle of the Tenderloin.
I seen this place and I stopped. I moonwalked back. And I said, oh my gosh.
Programs that serve the common good. Today on Cross Currents. In the most recent election, San Francisco voters approved a $500 million transportation bond. That money will go toward things like BART escalators, traffic signals, bike lanes. A bond, as you may know, is a loan taken out by the city to pay for big projects, kind of like taking out a mortgage to buy a house. But $500 million is a very big loan. And this latest bond is just one example of voter-approved funding. Since 2008, San Franciscans have signed off on almost $3 billion worth of bonds. But who keeps track of all that money? Well, in San Francisco, part of the answer to that question is people like you and me, ordinary citizens who volunteer to spend their free time sifting through reports, trying to make sure that projects stay on track. KALW's Raja Shah went to find out who's willing to take on the task.
Before we get started, a warning. I'm going to be talking about a committee today, a committee that has a lot of responsibility and hardworking, serious people on it. One thing it doesn't have is a catchy name. Just ask Rebecca Ryan.
I am the current chair of the Citizens General Obligation Bond Oversight Committee, also lovingly known as CGOBOC.
What did you call it?
CGOBOC. Not the sexy committee in the city that people fall over each other to serve on.
But a really important one, says Ryan. Let's break it down. That name again is CGOBOC. C is for citizens. That's you and me. Next is general obligation bond. That's just a certain kind of bond, one that's paid for by property taxes, which brings us to Oversight Committee. This is the group of 9 people tasked with making sure that city projects are on time and on budget. 9 people who show up to meetings every other month, visit construction sites, draft reports, pore over audits, all for
absolutely nothing. We get water and a pad at the meeting, and I do like the pads.
All right. Who would want to do this?
Oh, I sought it out.
Zach Townsend is applying for one of 3 open seats on the committee.
So I think I Googled for San Francisco boards and committees, and then, like, I saw this one, and I thought to myself, wow, here is a committee that seems really boring to most people, but is not boring to me.
Townsend says he sees the committee as a way to give back. Growing up, his family didn't have a lot of money, but he says strong public institutions like free school lunch programs and magnet schools changed his life. He's been interested in public policy ever since.
To me, it's not just like an abstraction. It's like real people's lives. You're making sure that like the money that was supposed to go to playgrounds like actually goes to playgrounds, which is the point.
So if you are selected, what do you think it's going to be like?
So what I assume it'll be like, really on a practical level, is like there's a pretty nondescript conference room with some extra chairs for the public, and not many people come, and you have a meeting once a month, and they seem really droll and dry.
Madam Chair, at this time we have a quorum. Roll call.
Townsend's prediction is not far off. Though instead of a conference room, meetings are held in a spacious hearing room on the 4th floor of City Hall. And yeah, they can be dry.
I must admit that at times our slide deck has been rather lengthy. This time we're down to 11 slides rather than the normal 20 to 30.
But they're also a chance to hear directly from city employees to make sure that the money for playgrounds actually goes to playgrounds, as Townsend put it. CGOBOC committee members sit in front of microphones on a raised platform across from a public seating area and a podium. One by one, managers for each of the city's bond projects step up and explain what they've been up to.
I don't know, many of you have driven by Mission Dolores Park lately, but it looks different.
That's Dawn Kamala Navin from the Rec and Parks Department. She's there to give an update on the 2008 Parks Bond.
And here are schedules. You can see again Mission Dolores. There was a commitment made to the public that we would phase the park's delivery, doing only half of the park at a time.
Outside of these meetings, each committee member keeps track of a specific bond project. So these meetings are a way for everyone to stay in the loop. And when a project falls behind, to ask some hard questions.
Dolores Park, there were some delays there. Obviously, the schedule is pushed out. What is the impact on the funding and contingency funds, given the unforeseen site condition?
There was, as a result of unforeseen site conditions from the soil profile, the stream, some soil remediation work that needed to be done, we're looking at an additional $2.2 million for the project.
And soil profile, remediation work. At this point, you may be wondering, how is a regular person supposed to make sense of all this? Most Segobach members, including Rebecca Ryan, are not construction experts or auditors.
I'd like to jokingly say I was a theater major. You know, what happened to my life?
The city controller's office actually has a full-time staff to conduct audits of these same programs. Segobach is an extra layer of protection on top of that. But it wasn't always this way. Back in the 90s, there were lots of problems with the city's bond projects. Wasted money, construction delays, mismanagement. The public's trust in government was low. So voters went to the ballot in 2002 and created Segobach.
It is in no way the only set of eyes that look upon all of these various projects. There are many, many checks and balances running through these bond programs. But one of them is the one you guys wanted.
It may be what San Franciscans wanted, but you wouldn't know it from those public meetings.
Is there a public comment? All right, seeing none. Any public comment on this report?
Okay, seeing none.
Okay, seeing no public comment.
Is there any public comment?
Public is shrinking with every passing moment.
I feel like I've asked for public comment six times in this.
Public comment on the committee comment we just had on the public comment.
All right, moving on.
The thing is, it's not easy to get people to show up to City Hall at 9 a.m. on a Thursday. So you can imagine that it's even harder to get people to join the committee, which makes Segobach hopeful Zach Townsend unique. Like, really unique.
Were there a lot of applicants?
At the time that I checked with the clerk, you were the only one.
Oh, how exciting. Oh, so I'm like the crazy guy who applied. Yeah, all right. That's cool.
Since I interviewed Townsend, a few more applications have trickled in, but not enough. The city has been delaying its decision on who to select for months, hoping that more people will apply. And Segobach is actually just one of dozens of committees throughout the city that are staffed by volunteers. Some do require expertise. Some, pretty much anyone can be on. Some are relatively self-explanatory, like the Elections Commission or Arts Commission. And some have even crazier names than Segobach, like my personal favorite, the Bay Area Regional Interoperable Communication System Joint Powers Authority, also known as the BayRICS JPA, obviously. Right now, there are about 100 open seats on these committees waiting to be filled. Residents of San Francisco can go to the Board of Supervisors or Mayor's websites and scroll through the full list of committees to see which ones have open seats. Just don't judge them by their names. In San Francisco, I'm Raja Shah for CrossCurrents.
If you'd like to get involved in San Francisco government, find a link to all the committees that have openings at klw.org. Click on CrossCurrents. This is CrossCurrents. I'm Hanat Baba. Now, number crunching on a committee may not be your style of community service, but you can find plenty of other ways to help out. In 2013, nearly 50 million Americans didn't have the resources they needed to get enough food.
And if you go back and you look at economic data, you see that since the mid-70s, we've seen a steady march of having more people at the bottom of the income curve, fewer in the middle, and a very, very tiny number of people at the very top.
That's Paul Ash, Executive Director of the San Francisco Food Bank.
And that's what's fueling more people needing food assistance every month. They can't earn enough money to feed themselves through the part-time jobs or the low-paying full-time jobs that they have. And it's increasing. It's not stopping. That trend marches on.
The San Francisco and Marin Food Bank serve 144,000 people every week. Today, we're going inside the main distribution center in Potrero Hill to see what happens behind the scenes to get food to the people who need it most.
We're here today in the distribution center where we receive truckloads, many truckloads every day of fresh fruits and vegetables, canned products, dry products like rice and beans. They come into our warehouse and they're stored, sorted, in the case of fresh produce, quickly turned around and distributed out to people in our community who don't have enough to eat.
Right now we're making our way toward the warehouse floor, and this is where all of our food comes in. My name is Blaine Johnson, and I'm the Media Relations Manager for the San Francisco and Marin Food Banks. So it's fresh fruits and vegetables. It's really healthy food.
The fresh produce mostly comes here from California, from Southern California in the wintertime, Northern California in the summertime. We'll go to Washington and Idaho for things like potatoes and onions, even into Northern Mexico in the wintertime so that we can have fresh produce year-round for our clients.
We have forklifts buzzing all around. It's very busy here in the morning. This is when we receive, you know, dozens of truckloads of fresh produce. So you'll see the employees moving those around on forklifts and putting them into orders that are going to go out to our food pantries this morning.
Hi, my name is Lloyd. Lloyd Jones. How you doing? Yeah, I'm what you call an order builder. What we do is we start from potatoes and yams and from on the pallet, and we build them up to make them look like this every morning.
They're just stacks all the way up to the ceiling, and we've got bulk rice. We've got other staples like oats. And what's going to happen is our volunteers come in every day. We can have as many as hundreds of volunteers a day, and they will repackage those totes of rice and oats into family-size one-pound portions. So we're going to move from the warehouse floor to our volunteer repack room. And in that room, we have a volunteer shift. I think it's kids today and maybe some adults. And what they're doing is repacking these bulk quantities of food into one-pound family-sized portions.
So, well, we're, like, sorting kiwis for people who don't have food so, like, they can survive. And we're doing it because we want to help people. My name is Stanley Chan.
John Mellon.
And his name is Ethan Tran.
Kids as young as 4 can actually come in and volunteer here. And it's a great way for children to sort of get back to their communities, get connected with people who might have a little bit less than they do, and quite frankly, have some fun. You know, you can hear them laughing and playing, and it's usually a pretty fun morning.
And our teacher wants us to help people that don't have any food. So it's good to help people.
With people that don't have much food.
Because some people aren't as fortunate as us, so it's kind of like a responsibility to help other people.
The people who enjoy bringing their families here to volunteer the most are our most significant donors. And I think they're worried that their children aren't seeing the reality of life in the United States. And so this is a good starting conversation, a good place to start a conversation.
So right now, they are wrapping orders on the warehouse floor. So they're preparing this to go out to a food pantry. So you've got carrots on the bottom row and then a whole bunch of beans on the top, which is a great source of protein.
Well, the food will go out from here, all to low-income individuals and families. Some will go out through schools. We distribute food in churches, which generally are kind of catchments for neighborhoods where anybody can come and register and get food assistance. And then we also distribute food in closed communities, so in Tenderloin hotels, seniors' residences. So those are places where only the residents can come and get food. It's a big operation, so it takes a lot of money to run it. But it's the individual that really keep this place moving.
That piece was produced by visiting journalist Rebecca Birungi. To find out how you can get involved with food banks in your area, go to KALW.org, click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Many of the people served by the San Francisco Food Bank live in the Tenderloin. It's the densest neighborhood in the city, home to roughly 30,000 people. That's about 750 people per square block. Many people live in homeless shelters or single-room occupancy hotels. There are low-income immigrants and families living in tall apartment buildings. Some, with nowhere else to go, stay on the street. You're more likely to hear police sirens than birds or other wildlife in the Tenderloin. That's partly because this is an area of high crime, but also because there's very little green space here. But that hasn't stopped some Tenderloin residents who've invited nature into their lives in the most unexpected of places. Reporter Allie Budner takes us to a place known to residents as the Tenderloin National Forest.
So can we go on a little tour here?
Sure. Right now we're standing in front of a more arid desert kind of feature.
The street sounds don't let you forget you're in the heart of the Tenderloin. But as soon as you set foot in this park, you know you've walked into a unique space.
There's the hummingbird again.
That's Daryl Smith, my tour guide.
And I'm co-founder, director of the Luggage Store Gallery with my partner, Lori Laser.
Together, they founded this place, the Tenderloin National Forest. It's off of Ellis Street between Hyde and Leavenworth. And let's be real, it's still a concrete alley sandwiched between tall brick buildings. But if you let yourself zoom in on what's in here, it really can feel like a verdant oasis. Trees and plants of all colors and sizes surround us. A water fountain filled with bright orange fish bubbles in one corner. A neon sign hangs over a shed with a living grass roof. It reads in cursive script, "Tell your stories here." An earthen oven, giant colorful murals on every wall. My favorite touch is the arrowhead-shaped greeting sign that looks a lot like the traditional National Forest logo.
It's comforting. It's very, very comforting. And it's very serene.
That's Frankie Madison. He comes here to relax.
In this chaotic city now, it's nice to have a little quiet place to be. Especially here in the Tenderloin. I mean, everything is so upside down and backwards that to step through that gate and to come in here, you just transcend to a different place. You're not in the Tenderloin anymore.
But if you had peered into this alley 15 years ago or so, you would have seen a very different picture. Again, Daryl Smith.
It was all asphalt. It was a classic inner city alleyway. There was a lot of garbage, excrement, drug paraphernalia. It was like kind of, it had its own story.
Which is in part the story of the Tenderloin itself.
It was a very dense and very mixed part of the city from very early on, without a lot of provision for open space.
That's Ben Grant. He works with SPUR, an urban planning nonprofit in San Francisco. He can think of only one substantial public park in the Tenderloin, Bodecker Park, built in the mid-'80s. But it has tall metal fences and iron benches. It's not that welcoming.
I think the contrast between Bodecker Park and the Tenderloin National Forest really reveals the importance of local stewardship and community advocates, especially in a district that has, significant problems with homelessness, with substance abuse, with social issues.
So how did they do it? How do you create green space where there's practically none? In the 1980s, artists Daryl Smith and Lori Laser were living and working in the Tenderloin, right near this alley. Then it was called Cohen Place. And at that time, Smith says the alley received an average of 1,000 police calls a year. So in the early 90s, they started a public art series there. They called it performance in the gutter.
And so we clean up, and then, you know, we do installations and have performances go on here just to kind of give a sense of what could be, you know, what the possibilities could be if we could, like, kind of turn it around.
But they couldn't do it right away. First, they reached out to their neighbors for ideas and support. Then they went to local nonprofits that helped them with research, planning, and connections so they could approach city government. A decade later, the city agreed to lease them the space for $1 a year. Then they knew they could really build something. But they started small.
So this redwood that we call Mama Tender was the first tree that we brought here to live.
And that's how it started. One tree, which is now 4 stories tall, by the way. As it grew, so did their vision. One day, they laid out a blanket of grass for an event. When they were about to pack it up,
somebody in the Senator Hotel just kind of whispered out the window, like, keep it. You know, I was like, wow. Well, that planted the seed, really.
And that's when the alleyway really started to change.
Garbage collector trucks didn't come in here anymore.
And when there was an emergency,
the fire department said, you know, we'll just bring in hoses and ladders. We don't need to pull a truck in.
These changes allowed the alley to flourish. Today, there's all kinds of trees. Pine, maple, lemon, olive, ginkgo. And not one, but 2 redwoods. From cacti and succulents to bamboos and ferns. Sages, rosemary, lavender, mint. The diversity of plant life in this small space is astounding. Anne Thomas was caught by surprise when she first saw the forest.
I was walking really fast, and I was, like, really upset because I had to search for a bed. And I seen this place, and I stopped. I moonwalked back, and I said, oh, my gosh. And the gate was open. I walked in. I'm like, oh, how beautiful. I was like, shh. And it was like, oh, everything is so cute. And I was like, oh, I wish I could bake something in that oven,
right?
You know, because you can bake food here. It's just gorgeous, and I thank God that this place is here.
Founder Daryl Smith says the neighbors have really embraced the forest.
The neighborhood's, over the years, has gotten much more involved in it, like taking care of it, watching over it.
But the park's most frequent visitors are the hummingbirds.
The hummingbird is kind of a magical bird.
It's the only bird that can fly backwards, and it has the largest heart in the animal kingdom relative to its size. But also,
it's the link, you know, it's sort of from green pocket to green pocket. Like, how does it get here? There's a whole, like, system of green pockets that that it ties together in its flight pattern. So they started coming here after we began greening the alley.
During my visit, a few ruby-throated hummingbirds flickered in. They'd hover for a sweet moment, then flicker away. Kind of like the neighbors who wander in and out of this space. For now, it's forest enough. From the Tenderloin National Forest, I'm Allie Budner for Cross Currents.
Is there a secret space in your neighborhood that shouldn't be so secret anymore? Or do you have a tip for a different kind of story? Tell us about it. Email us at news@kalw.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW. You can also call us at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team on today's show includes Leela Day, Jack Detch, Audrey Dilling, Sandhya Dirks, Rachel Dornhelm, Marcy Fraser, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Alexis Luna-Torres, Ted Muldoon, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. The line producer was Ashley Ann Craigbaum. Our managing editor is Jen Chien, who just became a mother yesterday. Congratulations, Jen! Our managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Bay Area group Hardly Strictly Jazz. They'll be playing Friday night at the Dolores Park Cafe in San Francisco starting at 7:30.
For KALW News, I'm Hannah Babel.